Yeah, so the question is, like, what would you have to believe to conduct that behavior? What would you have to believe to engage in that behavior? Because just like I said, you're a smart guy. You're successful. You're not naive to the consequences of what you're doing.
Right.
You're not naive to the consequences of what you're doing. So the question that really uncovers everything is, what would you have to believe in order to engage in this behavior?
Welcome to the Josh Bolton Show, where we dive into interesting and inspiring conversations. And now, your host, Josh Bolton.
That's good. Like,
sounds good to me, man.
Nothing like a live stream at 3 o'clock in the morning.
You're like, I don't have enough coffee for this, man.
Now I've got my sparkling water.
Oh, even better. What brand is it?
It's a generic brand.
Okay, well, your generic brand's way different than mine.
Yeah, I think it's Woolworths. Just like supermarket brand.
Okay.
Yeah, so it'd be like, would you have Winn-Dixie in California or Kroger? What supermarket?
Yeah, we have like Kroger's the big one out here.
Kroger, yeah. So it'd be like Kroger own brand equivalent. A dollar a bottle, man. Perfect.
Oh, man. It's not a dollar here anymore in California. It's like $2 for a 16-ounce.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. People complain about the price of gasoline, man. It's water.
Right?
Water's what's expensive.
It is. So I'm just curious, what was the backstory to you, why you got into your situation and coaching people how to handle the work-life balance?
So it's more like my focus is marriage, okay, relationships. Yeah. So I started out, I was probably, my first online business was life coaching. And that was mid 2000s.
Okay.
Just didn't have the skills to make that work. Like in terms of business wise, marketing wise, I couldn't get it off the ground. So I ended up getting a job in a marketing agency, actually, as you know, it's a long story why, but I ended up getting a job in a marketing agency. And for 10, 12 years, I went down that route of becoming a marketing specialist and became a marketing consultant and did very well, worked for some of the biggest companies in the world, actually. Learning working with business owners, and I could see that the problems that they were having for the most part, we're in the home. Like there's a lot of high performance men that had low performance marriages. And of course, if your relationships are not working, then nothing's working in your life. And a lot of the problems too, that owning a business created. So for myself, like excessive alcohol and drug use became a problem just because of the lack of certainty and the lack of security that being a business owner brings. You know, it brings, we go into business to create that security and create that certainty, but the reality is it destroys it for the most part, and most of us deal with that in a very negative way, and of course that impacts the relationship as well. So having been through that cycle myself and coming out the other side, and a couple of years ago now, 3 years ago or so, it's like I had the skill to bring the coaching business to market now. So it kind of went in full circle. I'm like, this is really what I want to be doing. I've gone into marketing kind of as I've just kind of fallen in that. But as a result of falling into it, I now have the skills to go back to what I was doing originally and realizing where the real demand or where the real gap in the market was, which is for business owners and for men that are really struggling as a result of going into business and not really understanding the uncertainty and the stress that brings. And then falling into the drugs and the alcohol and then the destruction that brings to a marriage as well, if that makes sense.
Oh, absolutely. I used to be a prolific alcohol abuser. And my wake up call was, my mom's a very patient person. I was living with her and she's like, yeah, if you keep drinking, I'm just going to have to throw all your shit in the front yard and you figure it out. That was like kind of that moment. I was like, oh, wait, I have a good deal here. Yeah. I shouldn't do that.
Yeah. Look, anybody who's drinking, I mean, they might think that it's under control, but the reality is, as long as you're drinking, your life is in free fall, it's deteriorating. And just because it hasn't reached a point to where you recognize that yet doesn't mean that it's happening. And unfortunately, like with marriage, really, you know, men especially, they don't realize their situation until it's too late. They don't realize until they've crossed the line and their wife has kicked them out or asked them to leave or asked for a divorce. Or they don't realize that they're in trouble with alcohol until they've crossed that line and they've tried to stop and they can't, or they realize that their life is out of control and they try to get it back and they can't. And unfortunately, we go too far. And the way we find out that we've lost control is that we've lost control. That's when people find out. Of course, when you've lost control, you're no longer in control and you're in trouble at that point.
And that's when people are, they've been biting their tongue the whole time, but finally they're like, we can't sit on the side. We have to tell them kind of thing. And that's when you usually should listen, but you're probably like a whole handle of Tito's vodka in and you're like, what? They're talking to me kind of thing.
Well, it's just like a lot. I think a lot of people know that they're in trouble. They're just in denial as well.
Yes.
They're just in denial. And like the number of people I've talked to, like even talk show hosts like yourself, where they'll start asking questions and they go, oh, well, I just have a glass of wine every night and it's under control. And then we dig a little bit deep and it's like, well, actually, it's a bottle of wine every night. And then
you only remember the first stress.
And then it's like, actually, it's a bottle of wine every night and you're not in control and your life's out of control. It's like, you know, everybody says the same thing. Oh, I just have a glass of wine every night. It does, you know, it just relaxes me. It's like, all right, well, that's the start of it.
The one eye joke with people, it's more like a close friend joke. It's like, if you're going to do something like that, like smoke marijuana or something, the worst that's going to happen, you're just veg and look at the ceiling and be like, wow, that's pretty.
Well, it's a better of the, like, if you're going to do something. Yeah, exactly. Like nobody gets high and starts a fight.
No, they don't.
You know, nobody smokes a joint and goes smack their wife around.
No.
It doesn't happen. It's like, if you're going to do anything, do marijuana, of course. Like that's what I say. I'm like, not that I'm advocating that either.
No, me
like,
neither.
It's
if you have to pick one, pick that one.
Yeah. But really the sort of where I focus, we can go either way with it. We can go wherever you want with this, but it's, you know, the business owners, like I said, it's high performance men that have low performance marriages. It comes at the cost of their business has come at the cost of human collateral.
Yes.
That they've damaged their relationship with their wife. They've damaged their relationship with their children. And they don't, by the time they realize that that's what's happened, it's quite often, it's very late in the day. And the woman has been warning them what's going on. Of course, it's the difference between the male and the female mind. The man is like, if I'm providing, I'm doing everything that I need to do. And the woman is like, I don't want your money. I want you. So the man is thinking, I'm providing for you. I'm being a good husband. I'm doing everything. And she's like, you're not being a good husband because you're not there. And you know, by the time that it gets to the point where the woman just goes, I can't take this anymore. I'm out of here. That's when the man finally wakes up and goes, oh, I've got to do something about it. And it's like, well, we left this very late in the day, didn't we? And usually there's, like I say, when you start digging, there's more to it as well. There's usually drug and alcohol use involved, or drug or alcohol use. And a whole soiree of negative habits that are causing the behavior and causing the problems.
Yeah, absolutely. Especially the high performers. It's sad to say it this way, unless someone directly, like a coach saying it to them, saying you're fucking up because of X, Y, and Z, they're never going to get the memo, because they're like, everything's steady. No one's telling me otherwise. Kind of thing.
Well, exactly right. I mean, if you want to piss somebody off, Josh, tell them the truth. That's the easiest way and the fastest way to piss people off. People go, everybody loves the truth. It's like, well, like Jesus told the truth and he got himself killed, didn't he?
Good analogy. Yes,
he got himself killed for telling the truth. It's like, nothing will piss people off faster than the truth. And it's like, nobody around you. And it's like, when I start working with men, I'm like, ultimately, it's the truth that's going to set you free. You've got to learn the truth. And the truth is, you're not who you think you are. You're not behaving the way you think you're behaving. You're not having the impact that you think you're having. And the reality is, like, almost everything you know about yourself, or you think you know about yourself, is not true. It's like you barely know your name and social security number. That most people do well to come up with that. It's like, that's about the extent of what most people know about themselves. It's like, what's driving this obsessive behavior in business, what's driving this self-destructive behavior and relationships and stuff like that. That's what we got to get to the bottom of. We got to find out who you really are. And that truth is going to be pretty ugly.
No, absolutely. And a lot of people do everything they can to not hear it. So
everything.
So let's say a hypothetical, let's say I'm a client that we see, came onto your program. Yeah. Yeah. I'm running a marketing firm. We're doing double digits growth, but I'm throwing back a pint of gin a day.
Yeah.
But geez, I've gotten my tolerance to the point. It doesn't like directly affect me. I'm not all slurry anymore. How would you first analyze me?
Yeah. So the question is like, what would you have to believe to conduct that behavior? What would you have to believe to engage in that behavior? Because just like I said, you're a smart guy. You're successful. You're not naive to the consequences of what you're doing.
Right.
You're not naive to the consequences of what you're doing. So the question that really uncovers everything is, what would you have to believe in order to engage in this behavior? And, go on.
Obviously, the only thing that came to mind if I was doing that, is that I wanted to feel numb so I don't have to be hurt, I guess. Closest.
So that's where most people start with an answer, something like that. But it's like, let's talk about like fast food, for example. That's an easier example to understand. If you know fast food, if you know fast food is harmful to yourself, yet you eat it anyway, what would you have to believe to eat fast food knowing that it's harmful? And when you dig, the answer is that I would have to believe that it's okay to eat food that's harmful to myself. Okay, well, let's go to the next level. What would you have to believe to do that? Well, I'd have to believe that I'm deserving of that harm. I'd have to believe that I'm deserving of that harm. It's like, now we're getting somewhere.
Yeah.
It's like that's where people go, oh, okay. Because at the end of the day, it's like if you're knocking back a pint of vodka a night, it's like, or anything really, it's like, you know that that's doing harm to you. And if you say, what would you have to believe then to continue in a behavior that you know is harmful to yourself? Well, I'd have to believe that I deserve that harm, or I have to believe, okay, well, let's go another level. You've got a marriage, you've got a wife and children. You know deep down inside, or not even deep down, that your behavior is damaging to that relationship.
Mm-hmm.
So what would you have to believe to continue in a behavior that is damaging to your relationship? What would you have to believe to continue in a behavior that you know is damaging and continue to do it? And it's like, well, you'd have to believe that it's okay to damage that relationship. You'd have to believe that I don't deserve that relationship, because you know that your behavior is going to destroy that relationship.
And or, it's like, okay. I want to interject there for a second, because I agree with everything you're saying, but what could it also be that they feel they're deserving of that pain?
Exactly. I mean, it's not, there are many beliefs that would be driving this behavior, and all of them negative.
Yeah.
For you to engage in a behavior that you know is negative and destructive, there are a lot of very negative beliefs or self-worth issues that underlie that. So This is what I mean when people say, I say people barely know their own social security number, right? They don't know the beliefs that are driving the behavior. They don't know the beliefs that are driving their behavior. They're uncovered, they're subconscious. So by asking the question, what would I have to believe to engage in this behavior? It uncovers the belief that's driving it. And then the next question, once you uncover the belief, like you say, the belief could be, I'm deserving of this negative outcome, or this negative outcome is what I deserve. Then the next question is that true? Is that true? And a lot of people go, well, for me to engage in this destructive behavior that's destroying my marriage, I would have to believe that I don't deserve a great marriage, or I don't deserve a great relationship. Okay, well, let's analyze that. Next question is that true? Let's get to the bottom of where that's coming from. And a lot of people will go, well, no, it's not true. Okay, so our entire life is built on a false belief. Our entire life is built on a lie.
Yeah.
Our behavior is being driven by things that are not true. So now you know what's driving your behavior. Now you know what you're making your decisions on. And now you know that that is not true. Now you have a choice. Now you can turn around and make a different decision and a better decision. And if you're willing to face the truth, if you're willing to do that, most people won't go deep enough. They'll just stop and they go, well, I'd have to believe that it's okay to do that. It's like, but you just told me it isn't, right? You just told me it isn't okay to do that. Now you're saying that I'd have to believe that it is okay. It's like most people are just not prepared to actually do the digging to get to the bottom of the belief, and which is where the transformation takes place, is in the transformation of the belief system. It's not in the transformation of behavior.
Right. Yeah, that's the biggest one. I've been reading a lot of books on that. Yeah. And wow.
Yeah,
it's amazing all the different nuances, like at least here in America, but I'm starting to realize it's everywhere, is like saying, oh, you need to do this, this, and this, which actually for an adult, because we can rationalize and compartmentalize. For a child, though, you're imprinting, oh, you are not allowed to have an opinion, you're not allowed to have emotions, kind of thing, which is very confusing because they don't know what the hell to do then.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, I give the example of like when I was young, I think I was about 5 years old, I remember my father came home and he was holding a glove. This was in England. He had a glove and he goes, is this yours? I said, yeah, it's my glove. And he goes, do you know where I found that? I found it on the side of the road up the end of the street. And he goes, you just don't deserve nice things, Cody. You just don't deserve nice things. Oof. And at the age of five, like coming from somebody that you admire and you believe and you trust, when they tell you you don't deserve nice things, if you believe that, then that impacts the rest of your life. So at the age of 30, it's like, I can't hold on to anything. I can get anything I want, but I can't keep it. I can get a business. I can get a relationship. I can get the nice car. I can get the income. I can get it, everything that I want, but I can't keep it. And I just keep going through this cycle of getting what I want and then losing it, getting what I want and then losing it. And I can't figure it out. And then finally, one day, I go through this process myself and you realize at a very young age, somebody who you trust told you you don't deserve nice stuff. And you believed that person. So whenever you get nice stuff, the belief kicks in that I don't deserve this. And of course you lose it. And if you have a nice wife, you're going to lose it. If you have a nice business, you're going to lose it. If you have a nice house, you're going to lose it. And that's just an example of like really getting to the bottom of what belief system am I operating on? What is driving me here? And as soon as I can get to that belief, which is I don't deserve nice stuff, the next question to shine light onto it is that true?
And absolutely.
The answer is no, it's not true.
Sorry, I meant absolutely as the question.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. It's like once I can evaluate and go, no, that's not true. I do deserve nice stuff. It's like now I'm set free from the behavior, the subconscious self-destructive cycle of get it, lose it, get it, lose it, get it, lose it. It's just that one belief that's holding me back. And it could be something as simple as like, you know, we've heard, you know, you'll never amount to anything. You'll never be anything. Why can't you be more like your brother? Why can't you be more like, you know, these things that are said to us that are seemingly quite harmless and they're not said with any malice or intent. They're just things that are said that were probably said to the person saying it. Just one careless sentence can impact the rest of somebody's life unless they become aware of it. And you know, if you tell a very young child you'll never be anything, and that is now the underlying belief, it's like the bad marriage is never going to go away until you deal with that. The drinking or the bad behavior is never going to go away until you deal with that. The self sabotage is never going to go away until that belief is uncovered and dealt with. And when it's uncovered and dealt with, then the behavior can change and does change instantaneously.
It does. It's surprising. Like for me, my biggest one, I was told at a really young age, like junior high, so like 12, 13, I had this crush on this girl, gorgeous, long black hair, like beautiful blue eyes.
Yeah.
And but I was the really shy kid. And so finally, it was one of those days she like approached me and it was like, obviously, I'm all flattered and nervous and shaking. And I had very crooked teeth. It did look like a canine's, like a monster that would bite you. And so she said, no woman will ever love you because you are a monster and you're going to bite everyone's throats.
Wow.
From woman I like had a huge crush on.
Yeah, yeah.
And for the longest time, I could never figure out why I couldn't build a lasting relationship with someone. And then recently, I tried online dating. That was a whole hot mess in of itself. But one of them actually realized I wasn't trying to be an asshole. And she said, you have a very bad belief about yourself. You might want to work on that. And that's when it came back to me. I'm like, oh, wait. And then pretty much I had to like NLP and restructure it and all that.
Yep. So yep, that's exactly what we're talking about for sure. Yep.
So I'm just curious for you. Let's say we're still going on the me being an alcoholic with my marketing firm pulling in 25, 30% growth every year.
Yep.
How would you convince someone who doesn't see anything wrong right now to restructure, to at least slightly give you some authority in talking to them?
Yeah. So to be honest, I really wouldn't attempt to talk to somebody who didn't see that anything was wrong. So it's like, you're not going to go into somebody who sees that nothing wrong and telling them, hey, there's something wrong with your life. It's like that's never going to end well for anybody involved. So for me, it's like generally speaking, when I start to get involved with somebody, it's pretty close to the end.
Okay.
It's pretty close to the end. So usually like most people that, they're in denial, then they realize they've got a problem, then they try to fix the problem themselves, and then they go back in denial again because they can't. And then there's usually some catalyst in their life. There's some event. It's either a health event, it's a partner, spouse leaving them event. They lose something as a result of their behavior. That's usually when people actually start looking for help. And with all of these situations, it's like unless you really, really want help, the pain of doing something about it has to be less than the pain of staying where you are to actually do something, because change is difficult, Josh. Change is painful, as you know. So for somebody to actually go through the process of change, then that has to be less painful than staying where they are. And that usually means that they're in a pretty bad situation, because the pain of the change is going to be quite considerable as well. So usually when people reach out and ask for help, they're usually in a pretty bad state at that point. They realize that they've got a problem, and that problem is probably out of their control.
Yeah. You're getting to the point where you got all the baggage and damage, and you're like, all right, let's sift through this.
Yeah. And look, you know, I know for myself, like if I'd have asked for that help earlier on, then the latter part of the journey would have been much earlier. But we're just in this state where like we go far too far down that journey of thinking that there's no problem at all. And then once we do acknowledge that maybe there is a problem, we continue far too far down the journey of going, I can fix this myself. When the reality is, I mean, if we're talking about alcohol, I mean, alcohol is a formidable opponent.
Oh, it is.
It's a formidable opponent. It's going to kick your butt every day of the week. It's bigger, stronger, and badder than you are for the most part. And without that external help, it's probably going to win the fight. But people don't realize that. It's not until they've been a few rounds with it that they realize that I'm dealing with an opponent here that's formidable.
Yes, it really is. I especially with my mother intervening and saying what she did, I think I was getting to the point I'd wake up, because I didn't have a normal job back then. I was like working an hour somewhere. Then I have like three hours. Yeah. I'd go to college and work an hour somewhere else. But I'd wake up at 9, walk down the liquor store, buy two tall boys, throw them back on the way home, and then eat breakfast. And I just, it was one of those when I was walking back and I realized I threw both the tall boys back and nothing was happening. I'm like, and that's about when I like blacked out, and that's where my mom said something. And I was like, this is a bit of a problem.
Yeah, exactly right. Yeah. Yeah. It's like in what world is that behavior okay? Right. It's like, but we do it for a very long time before we realize. And if we see our behavior in somebody else, it's very easy to recognize and go, no, that's not good behavior. That's not right. But when we do it ourselves, if you'd have seen that in anybody else at that time, it would have been a red flag, right? But the mind is very good at deceiving itself and allowing us to stay in that behavior much longer than we probably should, for sure.
So then let's say I am now ready to change as a client and I have all my baggage and stuff. What would be the first steps you would do to, well, we already established find a derivative of why I'm doing that, but what would be the next steps in that journey?
So the first step really is to create the leverage. It's like, what is this costing you? Because again, a lot of times we stay in the behavior because we're unaware of the cost. It's the same with marriage. A lot of couples get get divorced simply because they're not aware of the reality of divorce. They're not aware of the cost. They don't understand the reality of what's actually going to happen here when we separate and we divorce. They're not aware of the cost. And it's the same with drinking. The first step is to actually establish the real cost of the behavior. It's like, let's make a decision here. It's like, you don't buy a house without understanding the cost. You don't buy a car without understanding the cost. So it's like, step number one is, here's what drinking is going to cost you. Here's what it's going to cost you. You realize it's going to cost you your wife. It's going to cost you your kids. It's going to cost you your business. It's going to cost you your house. Have you actually sat down and counted the cost of what drinking actually costs? Because it's not the $4.50 for the tall boy or whatever it is, or however much it costs. And it's like, it's not that. The cost is significantly higher. So it's like, let's put the costs on the table. And now at least we're making accurate decisions. We're making decisions with real information. That's the first stage. Is to show the person the cost of their behavior. This is what it's going to cost you. And a lot of times that will create leverage when you realize that you're going to lose your children, or you realize that you're going to lose everything that you've got. Then that creates the leverage and the forward momentum needed to take the next step. The next step really is to make that decision and to burn the bridges. It's like, this is what I'm going to do, and what I'm going to do is possible.
I was thinking, I'll continue.
Yeah. No, go ahead.
I was just going to say, so then let's say I acknowledge, but I'm at that unnatural amount of consumption. Like if I stop cold turkey, it could actually hurt me. So would that be the slowly leaning off it kind of thing?
No. So I don't believe in weaning off and stuff like that. Weaning off is just a way to continue. It's the way to behave bad and feel good.
Okay.
It's the way to
That's
feel like
you're. Point.
It's the way to feel like you're doing something when actually you're deceiving yourself. You're allowing yourself to remain in your behavior, while feeling like you're doing something about your behavior. It's black and white. Like, obviously, I'm not a doctor, and if you're a severe alcoholic, obviously seek medical advice and follow medical advice. But generally speaking, it's like, nothing bad is going to happen to you with cold turkey. You're not gonna die. Like it's gonna be unpleasant. But the reality is, I mean, I talk about some spontaneous sobriety. So I experienced spontaneous sobriety. People go, I like that. I like the idea of spontaneous sobriety. Like, but all sobriety is spontaneous. It's like firing a gun. You fired the gun, went off, or it didn't. You don't wean yourself off shooting guns. It's like, the gun went off or it didn't. It's like, it's the same thing. You're drinking or you're not. You're sober or you're not. It's like all sobriety is spontaneous. There was a point when you went from drinking to not drinking, and that moment was a spontaneous moment. Maybe there was a history up to it or a story up to it, but sobriety is a spontaneous thing. And for most people, most people are not at the point to where they're, you know, they're sitting on the street corner with the brown paper bag. It's like their drinking is... It's like you say, it's like they're functional alcoholics. Mm-hmm. And the problem is not that they're going to die if they stop doing it. The problem is they're going to experience pain if they stop doing it. That's the problem. You're going to experience pain. And it's like, well, you're going to experience pain. There's no way out of this. There is pain involved at this point.
Oh, yes.
So let's just do it. Let's just do it. Let's just get the pain out of the way, pull the Band-Aid off.
Yeah. And that's kind of what happened to me. It's essentially... I think it was like 2 days afterwards. I wasn't drinking as much. Let's say I was throwing back like 10 beers. I was drinking like 5. But then as I think I was just sitting there and I was like, why am I doing this kind of thing? And I had a whole bunch I bought, and I essentially just gave it to my buddy. I'm like, just enjoy. Like, I can't drink them anymore.
Yeah. 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 And you know, that was like, man, like I quit smoking, and I carried a pack of stuff. I carried the last pack of cigarettes that I bought. There was about 12 cigarettes left in the pack. And I carried a pack of cigarettes and a lighter around with me for a year after I quit smoking. And the reason was, I'm like, this is not about willpower over... I'm showing that I'm stronger than the cigarettes. It's like, if the only reason I'm not smoking is because I have no access to it, then I haven't quit smoking. Or if the only reason that I've quit drinking is because I have no access to it, I've limited my access to it, I haven't defeated it. So I think... It's not about detaching yourself from the temptation or whatever it is that you're struggling with. It's like it's developing mastery over it. And again, the way to do that really is you give people a choice. You reveal the cost. This is the true cost of your behavior. If you continue with this behavior, this is what it's going to cost you. So if you continue with this behavior, you have nobody but yourself to blame. When your kids want nothing to do with you, when your wife leaves you, when whatever happens, you have nothing but yourself to blame, or nobody but yourself to blame at this point, because you've made a decision. You've now become aware of the cost, and you've decided that I'm going to continue in this behavior regardless of the cost. So a year from now, 3 years, whenever, when these things happen, don't get mad at anybody but yourself. Because it's one thing to start out, like we all get deceived into. I mean, you can't, if we watch Hollywood, the strong, powerful alpha male who's sexually attractive to women, he's got the nice crystal glass, right, with the whiskey in it and the ice splashing around at the bottom. It's like you can't turn the TV on without seeing the message in that to be a strong, powerful alpha male who's sexually attractive to women, you have to be drinking. You can't get away from that message. So, and especially if we see that at formative ages where we're developing our psychology, it's very easy to fall into that trap of, if I want to be a strong, powerful alpha male who's sexually attractive, I need to be drinking. And then we fall into that trap and we start drinking deceptively.
Right.
But now we're showing the truth of the situation. It's like, you know, that, okay, you fell into that deceptively. That's fine. But here's the truth. Here's the reality of the situation. So now you have all the facts. Make a decision.
Right. Yeah,
Make a decision.
That is very true. Yeah, I would have to agree. Like, part of the reason I was drinking, I thought I was like the cool guy, this and that. And then I was in college. It was a hot like year trying to go to college while drinking way too much. I don't remember most of that. But someone told me that they're like, "Are you drinking because it makes you feel numb, or do you drink because it makes you feel cool?" And I was like, I think option two. She like looked at me and she's like, "You're not cool by drinking. You're annoying. Yeah. No one wants to deal with you."
Yeah. Exactly. And again, looking at the underlying beliefs there. If you say, "Well, I'm drinking because it makes me cool," it's like, well, it's a self-worth issue, isn't it? It's like, I'm not enough without the alcohol. I'm not enough by myself. Or if I don't have the alcohol, I'm not going to be accepted. It all comes down to getting to those core beliefs and saying, well, if you're drinking because it makes you cool, would you need to drink if you were cool anyway?
Right.
Like, what need is this alcohol fulfilling? And getting to that point where it goes, actually, well, if you're drinking because you think it makes you cool, it's like, well, then the belief is I'm not cool. Or the belief is I'm not enough. And it's like, well, let's look at that. Let's start addressing that. And if we can get to a point where it's like, I am enough.
So
we can get...
Sorry, I cut you off again.
No, go on.
I would say, so on that note where it's like, I'm not enough, I totally agree. And that was actually the biggest problem for me. I had a crippling self-worth problem, like I told you earlier.
Yeah.
That was pre-primed a long time ago. But so let's say for that, I wouldn't listen to you inherently, because I would say, no, like the alcohol is more than enough to be my crutch and get me through problems.
Yeah.
But I'm still paying you, so I'm willing to kind of listen. So how would you? I would say I'm paying you, so this is the psychology. I'm like, I bear to listen because I'm paying them like $2,000 a month, kind of thing.
Yeah. Now, to be honest with you, you wouldn't be paying me if you were still of that viewpoint, right? It's like someone's and this is like why fees are important, because the better, like when you work with somebody, the better the result, the better the fit, the better the result. And somebody goes, I've kind of got this somewhat ish drinking problem and I'm happy to give you $500 a month or whatever, or $200 a month, or $50 an hour, whatever it is. Like there's no indication that they're serious about this. They're serious about their problem. If someone comes and says, like, just give a hypothetical number out there, it's like, I need help with this problem. Okay. It's $50,000 hypothetically, right? It's $50,000. The person that goes, okay, I'm ready to part with $50,000 to solve this problem, is a very different person. If someone says, I'll give you $50 or $100 or $500, very, very different person. And with all of these problems, Josh, there's a progression, right? It's like most people And if they're in that state where they think they can still solve their problems, or they think they can have their alcohol and drink it, or their cake and eat it, it's like, I can keep my alcohol and I can solve the problem. It's like, there is no solution for you at this point. You're going to have to deteriorate to a point to where you realize that you don't have control of the situation. The consequences of not gaining control are quite serious, devastating, and you need a solution now. And it's like, at that point, you're ready to do what you need to do to find that solution. And the fees are an indication of that. Someone that says, I need to save my marriage and I'm willing to do anything. Okay, well, we'll find out in a few minutes if that's true.
Fire me 50K and we'll see.
We're about to find out. It's like, I don't charge 50K. It's just using that as a hypothetical example. Right. But it's like somebody that is in that situation. But again, it's like high performance men, people that build businesses and people are very successful. It's like they're generally successful because they're covering up for an inefficiency somewhere else. It's like you can build that business to a very high level because that's where you're finding your self-worth and validation. It's like, if I build a very successful business, then that proves that I'm worthy and I deserve the space that I occupy in the world. So a lot of times, this is why we'll see like high performance people are alcoholics, or they have problems with addictions and distractions, is because the reason they've built something that is so high performance is because it's hiding an inefficiency of belief somewhere, or it's trying to make up for a lack of self-worth. They're trying to find the self-worth in the thing that they're building. It's like, if I can build something that's big, then that validates that I am worthy. When the reality is, that's like saying these spots on my face are causing measles. You're never gonna find self-worth in what you're doing. It's like, you have to find self-worth internally, and then that impacts what you're doing. You'll never find the self-worth from going, okay, well, I've built a big business, now I'm worthy. It's like, no, you'll just have a big business and you'll still feel the sense of inadequacy and lack of self-worth.
So I want to touch on something you said earlier, is the lack of self-worth, but inefficiencies. What is the two things that you see in your coaching? Is it just self-esteem, self-worth, value kind of thing?
Yeah, it all comes down to the same thing. It's like lack of self-love. If you want to simplify it and take it down to its base format, it's like an issue. It's a lack of self-love, root cause of all problems.
This is now just getting a little more on the personal level, but I'm sure. Mm-hmm. Do you think it's because maybe like a parent did something to, like, not in a nefarious evil way, but maybe was more stern and mean when he did a good thing, and it just somehow translated that they didn't feel like they were worthy of love? What you've observed. Sorry.
Yeah. So it could be any one of a number of things. So it could be a parent, like it could be a loving act that's gone wrong. So some, like, for example, like I remember my father making me polish my shoes over and over and over and over and over again, and just getting to the point where it's like, there's no way to make these shoes good enough for him. There's no way to make these shoes shiny enough for him. And it's like, in his mind, he's going, this is important because shoes are important. And if you have clean shoes and shiny shoes, that's going to give you better standing out in the world. If you go to a job interview and you've got clean, shiny shoes, you're going to fare better than if you don't. And, you know, I would say like the two things for a man that are important are a watch and shoes. I look at people's shoes and I look at people's watches. I'm like, if you've got a nice watch and you've got a nice pair of shoes, then the rest of your life is probably all right. I don't know if that's true or not, but that's kind of coming from that belief that my father has put in me. Right. So if you get to the point to where it's like, I can never achieve approval. I can never find that approval. Like, it doesn't matter how good I clean these shoes, I'm never going to find approval. That translates into every aspect of life. It doesn't matter how big I build the business, I'm never going to find approval. It doesn't matter how successful I am, I'm never going to find approval. It doesn't matter how big I build something, I'm never going to find approval. It's never going to come. So it can come from that apparent meaning well. It can come from apparent not meaning well. It's a manipulation as a society as a whole. It benefits the ruling elite. It benefits the people in society that we feel inadequate and we pursue materialism to fill that hole. It's like, if I feel that I'm not worthy unless I have the latest and greatest, it's going to keep me consuming. So there's certainly a a concerted push from the powers that be at every level of society, from Hollywood to the school system to every aspect of life, to make us feel inadequate, to fill that inadequacy through consumption. There's no question about that. So where this sense of self-worth is coming from, or lack of self-worth is coming from, you know, there's umpteen dozen different places it can come from. That there's no one place, but it is ultimately, it's the cause of all of your woes. Once I go, I don't need your approval, Josh, you no longer have the ability to manipulate me. You can withdraw your approval from me and I still feel whole. I still feel I'm still fine. Then the ability to manipulate me is gone. Whereas if I crave and need your approval or somebody's approval or society's approval in order to feel whole, then they have 100% ability to manipulate me, because they can remove that approval and they can manipulate my behavior to continue to get that approval, if that makes sense.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's a big one that I've just recently come across. Back to that like online dating thing, I felt like I always had to have someone. Also, my martial arts instructor was like, you have to have a woman to be successful in life, blah, blah, blah. I'm like, no, you don't. But like subconsciously, like, maybe I do, kind of thing. And look, finally,
yeah.
And finally, that's where I just told myself, I'm like, no, like you, I have to tell my subconscious, like, it's going to be a distraction right now. You're trying to build a lot. If you introduce a woman, even if she's the right one, you might push her away because you're so damn focused on this stuff, kind of thing.
Well, you're putting a requirement on her that it's too, you're giving her a burden that's too heavy to carry.
Right. Well, yeah, I am right now, or the way I'm rephrasing it, or
no. The with the attitude previously, when it's like, I need a woman to feel whole, or I need a woman to feel like I'm adequate. It's like,
right,
placing your need for adequacy on her shoulders is a burden that's too heavy for a woman to carry.
Right.
A woman's job is not to validate you. That's not like when you go into a relationship and the purpose for the relationship is it's a parasitic relationship, right? You're going into the relationship looking to take validation from the relationship. Fundamentally, is what you're looking to do, and that's not the natural order of a relationship. To go into a relationship to take that validation from the other person, or to find validation from the other person, you're off to the wrong start. It's like a relationship is somewhere you go to give. It's not somewhere you go to take. And this is why a lot of relationships fall on stony ground, is because the person goes into the relationship looking to take. I'm looking to take happiness from this relationship. I'm looking to take self-worth from this relationship. I'm looking to take validation from this relationship. And that's a weight that's too heavy for the other person to carry. And eventually they're going to get tired of carrying it and they're going to leave. If you go, once you have that self-worth, once you have that self-love, it's like you can then go into the relationship and give it. If you go into a relationship with the objective of giving validation, giving that sense of love, giving that sense of self-worth, giving it, not taking it, that's an entirely different scenario than going into a relationship going, I need to get this sense of self-worth out of this relationship. Like those relationships may work, they may stay together, but it's like, you're not going to be happy, or the other person's not going to be happy. It's only when you actually have that sense of self-love and self-worth and self-respect that you can go into a relationship and have a happy, healthy, productive relationship.
Man, you put it so well. I was reminiscing on what you were saying earlier. Like, no one actually wants to hear the truth. It hurts too much. Yeah. That was the biggest one I kept telling my instructor. I'm like, are you sure this is a loving relationship and you're not trying to fill a void and putting all that burden on her?
Yeah.
And he's like, no, we love each other. I'm like,
Do you?
Because they bicker like crazy.
Yeah.
And I was like, that's not natural. He's like, oh, it's totally normal. My parents did it. Her parents did it. I'm like, it's not natural though. That's just, it's not natural. He's like, well, you're not married. You don't know. And I'm like, I've watched enough married people. I know what's good and what's not.
Well, the reality is, Josh, most people approach the typical relationship is two starving people coming together saying, let's share our food. That's the foundation for most relationships, is it's two starving people coming together saying, let's share our food. And the bickering comes because you think you're going into that relationship, you're going to, you know, the foundation is let's share our food. When you realize that other person has no food, and not only that, they're eating the little food that you've got left, that's why the bickering comes about. Now you've got two people that thought they were going to get something out of the relationship, but all that's happening is they're having stuff taken from them. And that's where the bickering comes from. When I have such an abundance, it doesn't, you can eat all you want. It's like, come, you know, it's like when you can go into a relationship with Josh, and Josh is like, Josh is all you can eat self-esteem buffet. It's like, you can take as much as you want. You can eat as much self-esteem as you want. You can eat as much love as you want. You can eat as much validation and self-worth as you want. And it's still endless. They're still bringing out more. That's when the relation, there's no need to bicker in that situation. The bickering comes from when I've got a very small amount of food, metaphorically speaking, and you're eating it. And it's like, what are you doing? You're eating my food. Well, I thought that was the deal, right? We've come together to share each other's food. Yeah, but you're eating my food. It's like, this is where the bickering comes from at a very simplistic level, right? But that's where it's coming from.
I like that analogy. That's a good one. I'm going to definitely take that. Because that is so true. Like when one of my friends, he was like consulting me about relationship issues. And I jokingly said, I'm like, you're asking a guy who chronically can never hold a girl longer than a month how to run a relationship. And he's like, he somehow just like joked, like, well, you're probably the best then. Because he was like, okay. But that was what I kind of told him the same thing. I'm like, well, you're abundant in energy and she's a vampire draining you. Eventually the ratio, she's going to drain you too much. And then you're going to wonder what the hell happened when she leaves because she has nothing to take from you.
Exactly. Like I work with a lot of men, like marriage issues really is my main thing. Like that's really my main thing. And a lot of times the woman is simply exhausted. Mm-hmm. The woman's simply exhausted. And, you know, I had a conversation with a guy yesterday, a client, and he's like, my wife is saying that she's just not interested in continuing. She's just not interested. And I'm like, well, she's exhausted. Like she can't continue. It's like, it's not like I want it. There comes a point when you're absolutely, completely, utterly exhausted and you just can't continue. It's not that she doesn't want to continue. There comes a point when the vampire sucks so much blood out of the other person. They're just like, I can't do this anymore. It's not that I don't want to do this anymore or I want to quit on this relationship. It's like there comes a point when the exhaustion kicks in and they have to stop because they are simply exhausted. And this is where if you don't have that sense of self-love, self-worth, validation, if you're taking it and taking it and taking it and taking it and taking it, there comes a point where it's like the bank account's empty. I can't give you any more money. And it's like, you know, people say, my wife's saying that she just doesn't want to work on this anymore. It's like the bank account's empty. There comes a point when she can't give what she doesn't have.
Right.
The way relationships die is they starve to death. Very rarely does a relationship end from a gunshot wound. It's not like it's not sudden death syndrome in relationships. Relationships just don't suddenly spontaneously end. It's like relationships die of starvation. They starve to death. And it's like, when a woman is saying, or your partner is saying, I don't want to do this anymore, I'm not interested, it's like they're saying, I'm exhausted. I'm absolutely, utterly exhausted. I can't continue with this anymore.
So I'm just curious. So then let's say I'm that client from yesterday.
Yeah.
What would be some of then the advice now that I realize my partner, my significant other is completely drained and I didn't mean to.
Yeah.
What would be some of the steps then you would help me out with that?
It's every question, every action that you engage in with that person, you've got to first ask the question, is this for me or for them? Is this for me or for them?
Interesting. Okay.
Am I giving or am I taking? So like in an example here, there was a separation and he said, she asked for space. So I gave her the space. I moved out, yet nothing has happened. Well, did you move out for your benefit or for her benefit? Did you move out because she said, I need the space? And you thought, well, if I move out, that'll give her the space and then she'll let me move back in. Was that the true underlying motivation? Because if that's the case, then you did that for yourself, not for her. Or did you move out because you can see that she's struggling and regardless of what this does for you in terms of the status of the relationship, you did this because you can see that this is what she needs and this is in her best interest. Why did you do the things that you do? Was it for you or was it for her? And a lot of times you say, well, I'm doing it for the other person, but the reality is, no, you're doing this for yourself. And if you're doing it for yourself, you're taking.
Mm-hmm.
Stop for a second and say, okay, my wife's asked me to move out. I'm going to move out. I'm going to give her the space. Okay, well, why? Why are you doing that? Is this for you or for her? No, well, this ultimately, if we're actually brutally honest with ourselves, this is for me, because I think if I do this, this is going to get me what I want. This is going to get me back in the house. This is going to get me back in the relationship. It's like, if you didn't have to move out to get what you want, would you still move out? Of course not. So the antidote is always asking the question, is this for me or is this for that the other person? Is this benefiting me or is this benefiting the other person? And if the answer is it benefits me, I'm doing this because it benefits me, don't do it because that's you're taking from the relationship again.
Interesting. So then let's say I've gotten to that point and I'm working on that. Would it be the, like, I buy her favorite candy, a soft blanket to like slowly ease and show that this is, I care about you, but this is the only way I can think of to show you this?
Yeah. Well, what's the motivation? Why are you buying the blanket? Is it because it's going to get you what you want ultimately? Or is that because this is what she needs? What's the motivation?
I guess it would be kind of both, because it would be like those really soft Sherpa blankets. I've come to realize women and want those and need those at times. Yeah. So I guess it would be a hybrid of both, but I guess it'd be more 51% for her, 48% for me.
Yeah. So if it's for her benefit, then, and it's not, you expect nothing out of it. It's like if she gets under that Sherpa blanket and you kind of sneak under it with her and she pushes you off and goes, it's like, are you going to go, oh, that wasn't the plan? It's like, is the giving without any expectation of return? That's another question. If the giving is without any expectation of return, then absolutely 100% go ahead and do it for sure. But if there's any expectation of the of return, then the gift becomes a burden, right? Then the gift becomes part of the vampire behavior. It's like a lot of, like, usually if we receive something from somebody, it brings about an obligation.
Yeah.
It brings about an obligation. So if you and I were together, if I was in Los Angeles and I took you, I said, hey, I want to take you out for dinner. It's like, you're probably, if I pay for dinner, you're probably going to pay for dessert, right? You're going to go, I'll get dessert. Or you're going to buy, you go, let me get the coffee afterwards. Or it might be like, well, let's go get a coffee somewhere after dinner. It's like, if I pay for dinner, you're going to want to pay for the coffee afterwards. Because that's just the way the human mind works, right? It's like one, it's the reciprocation principle. When something good is done, then that there's a need for that to be reciprocated usually. And quite often it's very difficult for us to rest until that reciprocation takes place. If we do something for somebody, then they feel a need to reciprocate back usually. So a gift can quite often be a burden to somebody because it creates an obligation of reciprocation as well.
That's interesting. You know, I was trying to ponder, my boss, it's funny, he came in with a migraine. So I'm like, I'm just bebopping away at my place where I'm working. And I was like, oh, he has a headache. I mean, it's not the best thing in the world, but caffeine kind of helps with a headache. So I went and bought him his favorite Monster, and they were all freaking out and yelling at me. They're like, who bought this? Why are they this? And blah, blah, blah. I'm like, I heard he had a headache. I mean, it's not the best medicine, but here's some caffeine.
Yeah, yeah.
And then they all just like look guilty. I was like, I just take it kind of thing. I already paid for it.
Yeah. That's good.
But yeah, I was like pondering that when I was coming home from work. I'm like, why were they yelling at me? Now that you said it, I'm like, oh, they've been used too many times. They're like, no, we don't want it.
Yeah, a gift quite often brings about a need for reciprocation. So it's like, if you're giving it without any expectation of reciprocation, then that's a good thing. If there's any expectation of reciprocation or perceived reciprocation, then you're just taking, basically. You're taking from that person. You're putting an obligation on them that they didn't ask for and probably don't want, to be honest with you.
And then now that you said that, that's immediately what came to my mind. I'm like, oh, that explains why they yelled at me. They didn't mean to. They've been used too many times.
Yeah, yeah.
So then let's just say the biggest one that I've learned, and I'm sure you know this from your coaching, what if maybe like giving gifts to your significant other or woman is not what her preferred love language is? How would I go to find out what her preferred approach of showing affection would be?
Ask her.
Really?
Radical.
Transformational. Right?
Women, like, we don't, like, there's no mystery here. It's like, women tell us what they want.
Yeah.
And we tell women what we want as well. It's like, we just don't listen to each other. It's like, I tell my language, like, the basis for the relationship is like concrete language. Abstraction is the enemy. Concrete language is our friend. Say what you mean and mean what you say. It's like, if don't tell me you don't care if I choose the restaurant. If you do care if I choose it, don't tell me, like, tell me what you want. Just tell me what you want. That's the easiest thing in the world. So love language is like, I'm sure they're great and stuff like that. But really, it's like, that's going to be for the earlier stage of the relationship. It's not, if you're in a latter stage of the relationship where the relationship is in real trouble, bringing your partner in bed is not, breakfast in bed is not going to solve anything. Giving your partner a back rub is not going to solve anything. It's like, it's way too little, way too late at that point. It's like, if your wife is looking at you like you're Satan, bringing her breakfast is not going to solve the problem.
Oh man, that was brutal. I was just thinking about that. I was like, man. Yeah. At that point, it would just be like, okay, what can I do? What can I do to start repairing this? I know it'll take time, but what can I do right now to start? I guess that's too tactless. So what would be a better way for me to phrase it from your perspective?
Sorry, to rephrase what?
The what can I do right now to start changing things without seeming so, like blunt?
Yeah. So how can you start to turn if the relationship is in the latter stages, it's in trouble, how do you turn it around? Is that the question? What's the things you can do?
Yes. Okay.
So to change the way you see your partner. So I had a session yesterday with a client, and the question was, if you, in your head, the conversation that you have with your wife in your head, if I spoke to you the way that you speak to your wife in your head, could we have a relationship? Would you tolerate it? And he goes, no, I would not allow you to speak to me the way that I have the conversation with my wife in my head with self-talk. It's like when you're driving down the road in the car and you're having, your wife's not even in the car and you're having a fight with her in your head. It's like the things that you're saying to her, it's like, if you think that she doesn't hear that, you think that the other person doesn't know what you're saying in your head because it's self-talk, it's quiet. But I'm like, it changes how you feel about her, and that comes across in how you act towards her, whether you're harsh or whether you're soft, or all of these things. It's like, if you want to change the relationship, change how you see the person you're looking at. And it's like the gentleman I was talking to yesterday, it's like in the first year or 2 years, the honeymoon phase of the relationship, the way that you saw your wife in your head, start seeing her that way again. Start seeing the woman. Start talking, you know, in your self-talk, in the imaginary conversations that you're having in your head with your wife, start talking to her in those conversations the same way that you did in the first year or two of the relationship. Stop talking to her in your head the way that you're talking to her now, because it's negative, it's destructive. What language are you using to describe your wife? It's negative, it's destructive. Start using positive language in your self-talk. Start using positive images. See the woman or the partner that you want to see, not the person that your eyes are telling you are in front of you. That is how you change the relationship. You change how you see the person that's in front of you.
That's powerful. I'm just sitting here trying to process. I'm like, that's true. Like when you first are married, you love each other, the honeymoon, she's your princess, your goddess, like whatever you want to input. But then after time, the memory, not in a bad way, fades a little and you're forgetting, like, wait, was it this or this? Oh, she's being mean, she's a bitch now, kind of thing.
Exactly. It's like, you know, I'll talk to people and they go, oh, my wife's a narcissist, my wife's this, my wife's that, my wife's a bitch, my wife's selfish. And it's like, well, maybe she is. I don't know. Maybe she is. But is telling yourself over and over again that your wife's a narcissist, that she's a bitch, that she's selfish, is that helpful or harmful? Is that helping? Is that helping the situation or is that hurting the situation? And it's like, doesn't matter what she is. It's like, you can't change her. You can't, like, the goal is not to change her. The goal is not to work on her. I'm like, there's actions that you're taking that are harmful to this relationship right now that you can stop, that you can change, and you're not doing it. So why are you holding her responsible for this part of the relationship when it's within your power to stop doing things and to change things that are destructive and harmful, yet you're not doing it?
Right.
It's like, stop using, like, if if you tell yourself in your head that your wife's a narcissist 500 times a day,
when you have a conversation,
congratulations, she is right. That the first, I mean, how much narcissistic behavior does she have to demonstrate before you conclude that you were right? This much, right? This much. If the word narcissist has never entered my mind, how much narcissistic behavior does my wife have to demonstrate before I conclude she's a narcissist? You know, this much.
Yeah. The glacier ascent, the kind of thing.
Huge amount. Before I go, okay, something's wrong here. It's like, my wife's a narcissist. My wife's a narcissist. My wife's a narcissist. My wife's a narcissist. The conversation starts out from her. I knew it. There you go. I knew you were a narcissist. All you can do is talk about yourself. It's like, all I said was I was getting ready to say, I am going to the shop to buy some dinner. What do you want? It's like you self-fulfill the prophecy. You've prophesied that your wife is a narcissist and now you will fulfill that prophecy. So if you want the situation to change, you have to change how you see the situation. That's how you change it. You don't work on the situation. You work on how you see the situation. You change your perspective.
That can be hard, though. That can be really hard if that's especially entrenched from like a childhood.
Said it was easy.
That's true.
Nowhere in the warranty label of life does it say this is going to be evil. It's like easy. This is what I say when people go, it's hard. And I'm like, well, show me in the guarantee where it says it's easy. Show me the promise that life is easy. Like nowhere does it say it's easy. It's like, yes, correct. It's just hard. But here's the other thing. You have to live it regardless. You have to live life regardless. So it's like you can do the work and master it, or you can just go, this is hard, and live a very average existence at best.
Yeah. I was going to say, there's the one motivational speaker. I don't remember offhand who it was, but he said, if you want your life to be easy, you must do what is hard. And then he's like, if you want your life to be easy, no, you want your life to be hard, do what is easy.
Do what is easy. Exactly. I mean, Jim Rohn was one of my favorite speakers, and he'd say, if you can't do it, that's why you must. If you can't, it means you must. And it's exactly right. Everything you want right now, whether it's in business, whether it's in your relationship, whether it's in your health, it doesn't matter. You name it. It's like, tell me what you want. If you don't have it, the reason you don't have it is because it exists on the other side of comfortable. It exists on the other side of easy. Mm-hmm. People go, I've done everything. I've done everything to quit drinking. No, you haven't. You've done everything that's comfortable to quit drinking. I've done everything to save my marriage. No, you haven't. You've done everything you're comfortable with. I've done everything to grow my business. No, you haven't. You've done everything you're comfortable doing. Everything you want exists on the other side of comfortable right now. And most people, they want their cake and eat it. They want what they want, but they don't want to deal with uncomfortable, or they don't want to deal with difficult. So that, again, that's like, better the fit, the better the results, right? This is one of the things that I'm looking for. It's like, are you willing to push through uncomfortable? Are you willing to go through difficult? Are you willing to do the hard yards, or do you just want a quick fix? Because if you just want a quick fix, then you're not ready.
Absolutely. Sorry, I'm writing down anything you want is on the other side of comfortable.
Exactly.
That's a good one. Another one, one of my guests said it, but I've also heard it before on YouTube. I think it was that Dan Pina, the trillionaire eye tycoon guy.
Yeah.
Oil tycoon. Yeah, but it was, yeah. Would you rather have life be a slut or a bitch? And then whoever replies, like, oh, I want a slut. And he's like, well, the slut will just sleep with whoever he or she wants and not care about you. The bitch will help you, be mean about it. He's like, I'd rather life be a bitch than a slut.
Exactly.
And yeah, I just sit there and I'm sitting there going like, man, that he hit more deeper levels than he intended to on like the meaning of stuff. So yeah, that was just one of those I wanted to throw in there. I don't want to keep you up too late. Is there anything in particular that I might have missed that you want to go over?
No, I think we've hit a bunch of stuff here. Hopefully throwing some stuff out there that can help people get unstuck a little bit if they're stuck in their life in some way or another.
Definitely give this guy a call. Where can everyone contact you at?
So my main website is bettermarriage.com.au.
Okay.
That's kind of, you'll be able to find me there. I'm not difficult to find. I'm not incognito like the usual suspects, Facebook, LinkedIn, the social media platforms. If you type in Cody Butler, then pretty much you're going to find me. I'm not in hiding or anything like that. I'm not undercover.
Excellent. It's been an absolute honor and a pleasure to chat with you.
Thank you. Thanks for having me, Josh. Appreciate it.
I appreciate you too.
Well, congratulations. You made it to the end. You're an awesome person. Not many make it here. So, being the awesome person that you are, can you do me one more awesome favor? Can you rate and review this on whatever podcast services you're using? If you do it on Apple and you leave an actual written review, I have a thing on my website. I will take your written review and post it for all to see. Congratulations, you're permanently sealed on my site. Otherwise, I am trying to do YouTube more and live streaming. I will try to put as many of the YouTube links in the description of the show as I can. So give your boy some extra help over on YouTube. Watch my videos. I just mute it and change the channel, change the window or something. But yeah, that's it. Thank you for being awesome and see you next time.